Welcome to the Non-Breaking Space Show from Austin, Texas. I'm the Internet's Christopher Schmidt. And on today's show, I'm joined with Harry Roberts from Yorkshire. Harry is an award-winning consultant, front-end architect, writer, and speaker from the UK. He's often asked for his advice by web teams, large and small, to help make their CSS better organized and more efficient. Before we get started, some things I'd like you to know. I need you to make plans for CSS DevConf 2017. Grab your tickets now so you can learn from Chris Coyer, Wes Boss, Mina Markham, Harry Roberts, that we're talking to today, Estelle Weil, and many more in New Orleans. Tickets are on sale now at cssdevconf.com. The UX Design Newsletter is a weekly list of articles, tutorials, and inspiration handpicked by yours truly. Sign up at uxdesignnewsletter.com and have the best links of the week sent to your email. And speaking of email, set it and forget it with the Non-Breaking Space Show newsletter. Whenever a new show is ready, you'll be notified directly into your inbox by signing up at newsletter.nonbreakingspace.tv. Of course, you can find show notes and links discussed in today's episode, of which there are many, at nonbreakingspace.tv. And be sure to follow me, the Internet's Christopher Schmidt, at Telject, T-E-L-E-J-E-C-T. As always, thank you for telling others about the Non-Breaking Space. Now, on with the show. One thing I found out is that you're a Google developer expert. Is that right?
Correct. That is true. Yep.
Hey, what does that mean? And how do you get to become a Google developer expert?
So what it means is that I'm someone who is not affiliated with Google. I don't work for Google. I'm not part of any of Google's commercial activities. But the work I do is in a similar interest to what Google's is. So, for example, doing workshops about performance or teaching people, like clients, how to use DevTools more effectively. It's the kind of thing that Google appreciates people doing. So they've got this kind of network of people that they endorse, for want of a better word. But it's a pretty sweet gig because you would then think that kind of I have to say nice things about Google or I need to wear a Google t-shirt at every third conference, but they're really good about it. I've got no kind of gagging order. There is absolutely nothing to stop me getting on stage and saying how I think Google are evil. I mean, I don't. But I could take exceptions to Google in a public forum. So there's no kind of gagging order or anything like that. So they just provide support to developers. Good example would be, let's say a country, an emerging market, an emerging economy is running a conference and they want me to come and speak. Now, I work for myself, so I can't fly myself around places, but they might not be able to afford to fly me out either. I could go to Google and say, hey, look, this Indonesian conference really wants me to speak. I'm going to do a talk about X, Y, and Z. Can you cover my flights and hotel so that they don't have to? And then Google makes that cash available to people, developer experts. And then as for becoming an expert, anyone can do it. All you have to have is someone on the inside at Google who would vouch for you. So if you've got friends in DevRel or, I mean, you'll know tons of people, right? So you could just speak to someone in Google and be like, hey, I want to become part of the developer expert network. And then you go through the interview process and the second interview process, and then they kind of vet you, and then it's either a yay or a nay, and you get in.
Okay, cool. All right. Yeah, and the interview process is like, is it all day interviews or is it just like?
No, it's really kind of, it's not intense. It's not all day. It's like a Skype call kind of thing. You don't have to go anywhere in person.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty nice. Okay, I don't want to get too, like, I don't want to, like, you know, you give away all the secrets behind the veil of Google developer expert. So, but yeah, but I didn't know, it's like some people like, oh, I didn't know, like, it makes sense that some people, like, you know, I know, like, are Google developer experts. I didn't really see that until I think I don't know if you flew to Google I/O this year.
I missed it.
Okay, yeah, because there was like there's a group photo, like Rachel Andrews was in it, and I just like, oh, okay, cool. I didn't know she was a Google developer expert, and I was like, okay, cool, that's pretty nice. But
yeah.
But a lot of smart people.
No, it's a really good way of Google of just kind of acknowledging people, individuals who do just general work in the web, right? You were trying to progress the web. I mean, you could quite easily write about how amazing Firefox's grid implementation is, but Google would still treat that as advancing the web, and they're very sort of neutral about it, which is really good of them.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. So we'll just talk about a little bit, like, so you're Google Developer Expert, you know, kind of like you got that, you know, thumbs up from Google for the work that you do. So, like, what type of work do you normally do? Like, what's your normal week or, you know, day to day, I guess?
Yeah. So, I guess the normal work I do for clients is going to be a lot of auditing, consultancy mainly. So, advising and strategy kind of stuff. And that's nearly always on site. So, I don't really do any remote work. So a normal week for me could be early morning, like airports, you know, my alarm's going off at 6 a.m. tomorrow to get to an airport, to get to a client. So that kind of stuff. So lots of travel, which is incredible. Like, I'm the luckiest guy alive, but a lot of travel. And then when I'm on site, it was usually going to be a lot of hands-on work. So I don't normally just sit and get my head down. It'll normally be get a bunch of engineers, bunch of designers in a room. We just thrash things out. So it's very kind of hands-on work, which is what I really thrive on.
Okay, so thrash things out. What does that mean?
Like, all right. So it'll just be like. So I normally, for better or worse, I get hired at two different stages in a project.
Okay.
One, when it's brand new and it's exciting, or two, when it's gone completely downhill, right? When it's just firefighting. So the thrashing things out would be, we all get in a room and we just sling everything we know at the wall. We sling all the potential solutions and we just see what sticks. So it's a case of, we all just, it's kind of like, I don't want to say crisis zone because that sounds really bad, but it's kind of the stage you'd get to where you're just getting everyone all hands on deck and just really, really hands-on work.
Okay. Okay, cool. Sorry, just want to follow up. Thrashing things, like, so start a project when everything's great, or did you say, like, also when things aren't that great? Is that the other angle?
Yeah, so there are two main times when someone would hire a consultant. And yeah, the first one is when you've got a brand new greenfield project and you want to do it. You want to do it right this time. Famous last words. But or the other one is when a really mature project is a lot of legacy, a lot of technical debt, a lot of things aren't going too well at all. And they just need someone to come in and say, look, we've got this 10-year-old like legacy code base. We can't rewrite it for another 2 years. What do we do to kind of tweak out that last couple of years worth of longevity? Or you know, we can't afford to rebuild the entire application at all. We need to refactor the whole thing. So I get to see either the best or the worst of a project, depending on what the project is.
Okay. Like, do you do a lot of like coding on their project types? Like, do you get on their code, or do you just go there and actually, like, kind of like, just, you know, I guess I'm trying to get a feel for, like, you know, if I had a major project and we're not in a great situation right now, and things aren't, like, you know we need better performance. And you get us all the engineers in the room, like, what type of things would you expect us to have? Or would you expect them to, like, for me to give to you in order for us to work and stuff like that too?
Yeah.
Does that make any sense as a question?
No, that makes complete sense. So I guess it does depend on what the client needs. So if the client has got a really strong engineering team and they just need guidance, I would do very little dev work. I would come in and say, hey, look, show me what you've got. Right. What do you like about this? What do you feel is a bottleneck? And I might refactor things in a very kind of informal way. So a lot of the audit and performance improvement work that I do would be a case of, here, look, I've made a little experiment branch, and I've committed some stuff in there that is like a proof of concept. You need to work out if it's appropriate for you. You need to work out exactly how you're going to integrate it into the code base. But if you go in this kind of direction, then that work. So it goes from being really hands-off, it goes from being really kind of just guidance. But then, for example, today I was with a client, the NHS, they do all England's like healthcare services, working on a project for them. And I've just spent the last 2 days writing code nonstop. So for them, I'm actually building out a full kind of UI toolkit for them, like a pattern library style guide, whichever one we want to call it. So for them, I'm writing a lot of code, which is great because I think it's really important to keep yourself in each kind of camp, I guess. There couldn't be much worse than being a consultant who hasn't written a line of code for 5 years. So it's given me a real chance to just roll my sleeves up and get stuck into what everyone in this industry fell in love with in the first place, I guess. Just getting to write a lot of code.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so cool. So it sounds like it really depends on the situation, what the team wants, but like you're very flexible in terms of like coming to them and working things out. And so
absolutely.
So usually people will call you and say like, sorry if I feel like I'm just pestering you, but like, what's your job? But I felt like your job was like really awesome as someone who's into CSS a lot. And I was just like, wow, that's awesome. Just to fly in, help people with CSS problems and fly out. So, not fly out, but just like, hey, show them a way. Then leave. So yeah. But, kind of like Zorro, just come in like, hey, come on. What type of problems do people call you about generally? Is it performance? Is it, a clash of CSS rules, specificity issues? Is it something like that? Is that?
So what's really interesting about what I do is the fact that, it's really hard to get your head around the fact that someone's job can be CSS, right? Like, cause what you said makes complete sense, but I don't think anyone's ever technically flown me out somewhere because of like a specificity issue. But that's that's exactly the kind of stuff I'm fixing. But normally I get involved at a way more kind of like organizational level, I guess. So the problem would actually be something more like, hey, look, we had a really quick MVP kind of stage. We've got this product together. We know that it works. We've got to make it last for the next 5 years. But our biggest bottleneck right now is that we've got one designer and 8 back-end developers trying to write CSS. So what I would probably do is go in and say, okay, well, your designer is working like this. None of you are really proficient with CSS because that's not your job. So I would do stuff like, how do we find a workflow that's going to mean that you can scale your team? You can scale your code base without needing to scale the team. That's going to be one of the problems that I would normally solve. Or the other one is the kind of the refactoring gig where someone sort of brings it like, hey, Harry, look, we've got like a million types of button. We've got 18 different types of accordion. We've got a new designer who's doing a design audit and we want to just sanitize the entire look and feel and make sure it's like nice and tidy. And we also want to roll it out across 3 different applications rather than just one. And we need to theme it and we need to do this kind of stuff. So it would be kind of end to end. My work kind of starts with the design process. I always joke that I'm a failed designer. I always wanted to be a designer, but just can't make things look nice, which is kind of key to being a designer. So what I ended up doing was fully understanding and appreciating the design process. So I get embedded in design teams more than engineering teams. I champion them. I facilitate them. One thing I find is that nearly every company I've worked with, the amount of engineers is way, way, way higher than the amount of designers. So the designers are always on the back foot. They're always kind of trying to play catch up. So my job is to kind of champion them, facilitate them, and just make their work a one-to-many relationship. One designer can still service 3 applications rather than them just being worn out. And also things like how do we enable software engineers to implement or even write CSS whilst doing minimal damage? You can always tell when an interface is being built by an engineer or designed by an engineer. So I kind of try and occupy that middle ground where I keep everyone as happy as possible and keep everything as safe and like well guarded as possible, I guess.
Okay. So I guess there's a lot of things I want to follow up on that one. I guess what tips do you have or tricks do you use to like scale engineers to understand CSS more when you have that offset of like, one CSS designer to like 8 plus or many, many engineers?
That's such a good question. So there are a few tips, right? One of them is just don't tell them everything. Or to reword that slightly, a lot of back-end developers, a lot of software engineers just do not care about CSS. And they never will care about CSS. And that's fine. That's completely fine. Like, it's not their job to care about CSS. So if you think you might be working within a company where they have those kind of people, what you want to do is you want to safeguard as much of the complex stuff. So any of the architectural decisions, hide them behind something. Hide them inside like a, hey, look, here's the framework. Don't worry about what's going on in here. It's a version dependency. Don't go in there. It's fine. Just trust us. And then for those kind of backend developers who just want to consume, that's when you've got your kind of internal framework, which is just, hey, this is effectively your API. Use this class to do this. Use this class to do this. So at the very, very most guarded level is just don't bore them with things they don't care about. Just, it's fine. You don't need to know about it. It works. Just trust us. If you use these classes, they will always work. If we're going to deprecate them, we'll give you deprecation warnings and you've got enough time to react. If you've got software engineers who do care a bit more about CSS, and I'm finding that more and more because software engineers, they enjoy a challenge. They always want to learn something new. One of the key things I've done over the last few years is actually study software engineering principles and sort of take traditional computer science methodologies from the 60s, 70s, 80s and apply those to CSS. So whereas CSS was traditionally seen as a really kind of toy language, you know, color red, almost like offensively simple, that's why a lot of people gloss over it. Whereas what I would try and do is say, hey, look, do you know that thing that you told us about, that thing called cyclomatic complexity? And you see the software engineers like, yeah, we know what cyclomatic complexity is. And it's like, well, that happens in CSS as well. And the way it happens in CSS is X, Y, Z, A, B, C. And all of a sudden you see light bulbs turn on like, oh yeah, I guess it does. I think general advice that I've given out to a lot of developers over the years is only tell people what they want to hear. don't tell project managers you've got a specificity issue because they don't care. It's not their job to care. Tell them that you've got a niggly bug that you're going to try and solve. Don't tell programmers about Flexbox. Tell them about cyclomatic complexity. It's the easiest way to get someone on side is if they are already preconditioned to hearing what you're telling them, they're going to absorb it way quicker.
Right. I mean, like, I laugh because it's so true. Really? but yeah, because like, you know, you want to, you know, if you you want to speak their language, I think is a better kind of a more polite way of saying that. Yeah. So
absolutely.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, like, and people do not want to get bogged down. Like when you know if a plumber comes and fixes the pipes, I really do not need to know about piping. Glues, fixations. I want to make sure my kitchen is not sinking. Yeah.
Exactly. Because if your plumber comes around and starts telling you about like, oh, well, this U-bend was invented in the 70s, you're just like, dude, I think you might be scamming me. Like, I don't know enough to challenge what you're saying. Therefore, I think I might be getting ripped off. Whereas if your plumber just says, look, that was pretty nasty. You need to keep an eye on things a bit more. You need to make sure you're not like flushing rocks down the sink. But I fixed it. It's like, oh, okay, I understood all of that. Therefore, I trust you. And I think a lot of it, yeah, exactly. The plumber analogy is a good one. I'll probably use that. Thank you.
No problem. It's all yours, man. So what tools do you use? Like, you know, is it just like, you know, I assume Chrome Developer Tools and, you know, Web Page Test. Is there anything more than that? Or is it anything else than that? Or is it, you know, do you have your own collection?
So, well, of course, you named the single most important one, which is DevTools. Could not live without that. So when it's for performance work, Web Page Test, I think, is just the most amazing bit of kit. I think Web Page Test is just such a fantastic, powerful tool. So I use that every time I do any performance testing. Other things for performance work, Charles Proxy. Don't know if you've used Charles much before, but the main thing I use there is you can selectively throttle individual domains. So I can, when I'm testing a client's website, I can just tell my entire machine any request from this client's website, slow that down to 3G, but leave my entire machine running on Wi-Fi. So Spotify still works, Netflix still works. So I use Charles a lot for performance stuff. SpeedCurve for monitoring performance. That's a really great tool. So performance things, it's mainly going to be DevTools, Web Page Test, and Charles, things like that. Okay. For CSS, there's an amazing tool. I guess we can put these in the show notes, right? There's a tool called Parker. And Parker was, it was born right here in Yorkshire. And Parker's a really nice command line tool where it's just Parker and then path to stylesheet.css. And it'll just do some static analysis. It'll just read over the style sheet and it'll give you back reports on how many ID selectors it found, what the highest specificity selector is, what the average specificity per selector is, how many importants were used. So when I come to a legacy project, I use Parker just to see generally what's wrong. And it shows you the worst offender. So it shows you that this is the top specificity selector. It's got five IDs and, you know, six classes in it. So that tells me, well, we'll start here. We'll start refactoring this first. So Parker is amazing. There's a GUI, not competitor. There's a very similar tool called CSSstats.com, which is a much more GUI-oriented way of doing things.
Yeah.
That's really good if you've got any design debt. So if you're working with teams where they've got, you know, 15 shades of green and a million shades of blue, this gives you really visual feedback about your style sheets. So CSS Stats. And then other just command line utilities. So I do a lot of audit work. I join a lot of kind of mature and legacy applications where there could be, I don't know, a million lines of code. So things like ACK, if you've used ACK before, is great for just searching through projects, C tags, things like that. So I can start to build like a bit of a topology of a project without having to have 10 years experience with it.
Okay.
That's for the auditing and kind of that work.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. That's awesome. That's some great tools. Yeah. So Chrome, you know, Chrome DevTools is, you know, number one for everyone, I think.
Absolutely.
So how did, you know, I still feel like I have butter hands, if that's a word or expression, when I use it. So how do you feel like, any tips on becoming a master or better at Chrome DevTools? Like, well, what do you usually use Chrome DevTools for? I guess is another way of saying that. It's like, how do you become better at?
Well, so one thing I find really interesting about DevTools is there's the obvious stuff we've been using forever, like, you know, right-click inspect element. That doesn't really change. But the problem comes with things like the timeline profiling tools. They change, like Chrome's developers update how the DevTools work so often that often their documentation becomes out of date. So you'd be reading docs that are like maybe only 2 weeks old, but they're already out of date. So just a lot of experimentation, a lot of designing test cases and thinking, well, I don't know how this feature of DevTools works, but if I break this bit of the page, does this DevTools thing change? So I do a lot of kind of almost reverse engineering. But my biggest secret is just keeping on top of the Canary updates. So in Canary's DevTools, I actually have a What's New panel. And the What's New panel will give you effectively a change log of whatever's happened inside Chrome's DevTools. For more high-level stuff, there's a guy called, I'm going to pronounce it wrong because I'm just terrible, Umar Hansath. And he's, we'll definitely put a link to his stuff in the show notes. He's got a DevTools newsletter. And once a week, you just get like a little animated GIF showing one specific. You subscribe to that?
Yeah.
So like there's some absolute, like a lot of the stuff in there I already know because it's like kind of my job to be in DevTools.
Right.
But every now and again, there's something that's like, oh, I had no idea that existed.
Yeah.
And it changes everything. So he's a real treasure trove for stuff like that.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I've never, like ever since the Netscape Navigator betas of 3, I've never really been a browser beta supporter, so just how bad that was back in the day.
Yeah.
So, but I definitely will try Canaries, I guess, more.
Well, the last update to Canary, the actual network tool stopped working. Yeah. So I use Canary for a lot of like really bleeding edge performance tools.
Right.
And the network panel just completely doesn't work in Canary at the moment. It's just gone.
Right.
So that's the risk you run. So all of my normal dev work and browsing work happens in stable, but if I want to do some really forensic things, I'll fire open Canary and we'll see what's going on.
Okay. I guess this is a stupid question, I guess, but, can you have Canary and the regular Chrome at the same time or?
They're completely sandboxed. So they've got, one kind of annoying thing. Well, not annoying, but, any custom flags you turn on in your regular Chrome, you have to double up the work because they are completely sandboxed. You have to then go into Canary and turn on all the exact same features there as well. The benefit of that is, like say, complete sandboxing, but it does mean if you turn on a sweet new feature in Chrome, you've got to go do the exact same legwork in Canary.
Okay. All right. Well, that's not too much trouble. I mean, it's, you know, back in the day,
it's worth it.
Yeah, it's worth it. Like back in the day, you actually had like uninstalled, reinstalled browsers. It's like,
Just buy a whole new computer.
Oh, I wish, man. That'd be awesome. Cool. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, engineers who don't know CSS or don't want to know CSS, like you said before, I won't go back to this, like you're totally cool with them not knowing CSS because it's not part of their job. Can you shed light on CSS and JS? What does that mean exactly? Because I feel like there's a tweet. I'm going to have to find this tweet, but I was just like, I'm going to go find the tweet, and then I'm going to figure out, because I'm going to butcher the phrasing of it, but I was just like, there's one is like, CSS is too hard, is what engineers say, and then also CSS is too hard, we need to put it in JavaScript, and CSS is too simple, we shouldn't have it, pretty much. It's like, you know, basically like the same argument from engineers. It's like,
it does seem fairly paradoxical. I mean, my beef with the whole CSS and JS thing is that it's just born. Like, I've done CSS for like 10 years now. I've done it on consultancy basis, genuinely for some of the biggest companies in the world for the last 4 years. You can scale CSS. The only reason people struggle with it is because no one bothers to learn it properly. No one really has the discipline or diligence. And what's really galling for me is the fact that instead of people saying, do you know what, we need to hire some specialists. So we need to hire dedicated front-end developers who only know HTML, CSS, and who are, it's their job to make sure it's good. Instead of doing that, they throw the baby out with the bathwater. They take CSS away from designers and front-end developers. They bring it into the fold of software engineers. So now all of a sudden, people who are happy writing basic HTML, CSS, and doing design work, they now have to have a thorough understanding of JavaScript. Maybe not thorough, but they need to understand JavaScript now, or they need a way more complex tool chain. And it's gone from, I just feel it's like an air of almost arrogance, in which people have said, well, do you know what, we couldn't be bothered learning CSS properly, so we've decided to just re-implement it wholesale in the thing that we do understand. And it kind of leaves everyone else just thinking, oh, wow, well, we were quite happy doing this properly, but now I guess I've got to completely change how I work because the software engineers have decided to make it their realm now. So for me, the kind of philosophical argument behind CSS and JS is it's not a nice one. I don't like it from that point of view. Also, what you've got to remember as well is it doesn't actually solve that many problems. It doesn't. You still have the cascade. You still have inheritance. All it will really give you is co-location and random class names. So you'll still, if you nest something inside something else, it could still turn the wrong color, or your buttons could accidentally become underlined. So it doesn't guard you against anything that a lot of people assume it does. It gives you co-location and it gives you random class names, so you don't get naming collisions. It actually doesn't solve very much that traditional CSS hasn't solved already. I think things like web components that will give you co-location insofar as all your components live together, but they're still in CSS is in CSS, HTML is in HTML, JavaScript is in JavaScript. But it does give you shadow DOM, so it does give you complete encapsulation. Like, that's the gold standard. However, to play devil's advocate, I also think there's a bit of hypocrisy. When SAS was invented, we were writing our CSS in Ruby, and no one cared. No one cared we were writing CSS in Ruby. When Less was invented, we were writing our CSS in Node, which is JavaScript. So Less is technically CSS in JavaScript. So if you view CSS in JavaScript as just being like a pre-compiler, then it is really no different to SAS or Node or Less, for example. So for me, the beef isn't with the technology. My issue is way more with the philosophy of why it exists in the first place. It kind of feels like a bit of a hey, look, we're really clever software engineers. We all graduated Harvard. We're all like CS students. Right. We don't really understand the front end, so we decided to do what we know best, and we reinvented it for you. Right. And it kind of like, well, you don't really understand like decades of the web, like as a philosophy behind us. So yeah, my beef is way more philosophical. This is a good one for like down the pub with a beer. I
think. Well, yeah, if I could, I would slide you one right now. But
we can pick it up in New Orleans.
Okay, that's fine. I feel like, it's just, you know, JavaScript is everywhere, and I just feel like it's only natural for, you know, once engineers like, oh, we've conquered the server, let's go and knock off this this designy bit, you know, and see what happens. So, and I think they find out that it's just not that simple. do that. I mean, there's lots of reasons why it took years to get style sheets right, you know, in the browser and everything like that. So it's not as
absolutely.
But yeah. So, I mean, I still remember, you know, IE trying to get style sheets right.
They're still trying.
Yes, that's right.
That's so nasty of me. Yeah. IE are actually doing amazing work as well.
Yeah, they're doing great. So, but I feel like I'm also like kind of like a guy who's been doing CSS forever, and so to see JavaScript kind of like trying to usurp, you know, they totally can, and they do what they want to do with CSS. But I just feel like it's like the gains as you mentioned aren't that many to what exactly. they get out of it if they just, you know, maybe took a day workshop with you and they're like, oh, okay, I got it now. So and working with that. So but then it's just like, oh, how many engineers will really, you know, you say like in your workshops, you know, how many engineers are actually going to come to your workshops or, you know, private or whatnot? It's like, hey, I'm going to actually want to learn something new rather than try to like bring it to my own domain instead like that. So, but yeah, so it just depends. Yeah.
I'm just going to keep on fighting the good fight, I think is what I'm going to do. I'll do my bit.
All right, cool. So in doing research, it was a kind of a dated interview, but I felt like it had a number of, so I felt like, oh, this is a good thing to bring up. So it's like there, you wish browser support four things and CSS grid, web components, all initial and custom properties. And so CSS grid, which is like CSS layouts, if you will, custom properties are, you know, is another name for CSS variables. Is that right? Is that good?
Correct.
All right.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. So the two things I would like to explain more is just, you mentioned web components earlier. I have a vague notion of what web components is, but if you can just explain what they are and how people listening can, like, you know, can benefit from that, as well as all initial as well too. So I agree.
Cool. So web components. Web components is a formal kind of spec, formal standard, which basically defines encapsulated bits of UI. So let's say you're a restaurant and you use a third party to do bookings for tables. Now, normally you probably put an iframe on your site and the iframe communicates back to the third party and does all the booking that way. The reason we use an iframe is just to get that sandbox. Oh yeah, yeah. So like what a web component would give you is if you've got like a widget that is on your site that's fairly self-contained, it's got its own little responsibility, like a booking widget or a little calendar date picker kind of thing. A web component could wrap that up into its own custom template, and you'd use custom tags like, or custom element like, you know, date picker, similar to HTML5, but you can invent your own tags in, or elements, I guess. Custom element called date picker. Date picker would have its own shadow DOM. So shadow DOM means that anything from outside of the page can't leak in. So you could do like on the main document, you could do star font weight bold important. And that would not leak into your custom element because it's got shadow DOM. It's completely encapsulated, completely safeguarded. And then we get co-location. So that custom template uses its own JavaScript file, its own CSS file, and they all run in this kind of this isolated context. So that means that we can still use the technologies we know and love. We can still write CSS in CSS, write JavaScript in JavaScript, HTML in HTML. So we get all the benefit of everything we know and love, but we also get all these extra goodies as well. If anyone's interested in experimenting with web components, enough browsers support them that you can experiment. But Polymer by Google is a decent polyfill. So Polymer is a good way of experimenting with web components. I don't know if I can name them, but I was working with a client last year, huge American corporation, the ninth biggest company on the planet. They're building applications that are going to be used or implemented by 40,000 software engineers, and they're using Polymer. So it's big enough, it's stable enough for enormous companies to be using this stuff. So that's web components in quite a big nutshell. And all initial is unreal. The amount of people who haven't heard of all initial who then proceed to get their minds completely blown by it, that never gets old.
Okay.
All initial basically is it sets all properties to their initial values. So it effectively stops inheritance. So if you had an HTML page with body font weight bold, HTML color red, any bit of text in there, you'd expect to be bold and red, right? Because of the cascade, because of inheritance. If you were to put a span in the middle of that page, sure enough, it would turn bold and red. But as soon as you do span all initial, it goes back to being black and regular font white.
Wow.
So all initial just sets all properties back to their initial value. Oh. It effectively stops inheritance.
Right, yeah.
Browser support is pretty, there's a lot of, when you go to caniuse.com, there's a lot of green, right? Which right. looks really, really, really reassuring.
Right.
There are two really concerning bits of red, and that's IE and Edge. So basically, all initial, it effectively stops inheritance. It will reset any DOM node back to how it would have looked with just browser styles applied to it.
Right.
So it will strip off anything it's inherited. So this is really useful if you're, I'm sure you've been on projects before, right, where it's like a 12-year-old website, and the client says, oh, can you add this new feature to the homepage? And you spend all your time defensively undoing other people's mess. It's like, oh, why is it turning red? Oh, it's because of this. Why is it floated right? Oh, it's because of this. Just drop all initial in there, and yep. it'll just go back to having browser styles, and then you get to start from scratch again. Yep. So all initial is perfect. It's so good.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, so I assume that if you do apply all initial, that you can just also in the same blocks write new CSS rules for that element or as well, so that you can, is that right?
Yeah. So you put like class equals new thing. A new thing would have all initial, which sets it back to Times New Roman black. Then right underneath all initial, you could say Helvetica, 12 pixels,
oh, nice.
whatever. So you can use all initial first to get back to zero, and then straight after it, start writing your new CSS,
right.
which is really great.
Awesome. So it's like a mini reset, CSS reset. Right.
It's exactly that. It's like a one-line reset that only affects specific DOM nodes where you drop it onto.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And I just wish you can do really crude workarounds. So if you put like all initial onto any element, just open like Inspector and put all initial on something on a page, then you click on the computed styles for that DOM node, you will see a list like 3 meters long that says, you know, background position 0, 0. Background repeat none or whatever. So it shows you what it all computes to. So if you want to do a really nasty workaround to support old browsers, you just copy and paste that entire list of computed styles and put that in a mix in somewhere, or put it in an IE style sheet and just extend it maybe. But yeah, if you're working on modern browsers, all initials perfect, especially if you're working with legacy code.
Okay, cool. That's awesome. Yeah, that does blow my mind. Thank you so much for that. So that's pretty awesome. So, I need to find out who I need to yell at the browser vendors to get that started.
So. That's a good point, actually. I'm sure we could go and look at the IE kind of roadmap and see where all initial is. If it's not even on there, we should definitely start putting on and voting it up.
Right. Now that we have Flexbox and CSS Grid, I think we're like, I think that's a good thing to pick up. So
absolutely.
After that, that's awesome. Your views on SAS versus post CSS, or you sound like you're a SAS person. So
I'm a SAS person, mainly because it's what I've been using for so long. I don't have like a one versus the other. It's such a politician's answer, but I don't have like a one versus the other. So some interesting tooling I've been doing lately is to use a bit of both. So use SAS for the things that it's good at, and then pass the so for example, writing all your variables in pure CSS custom properties instead of SAS variables, using those in your SAS files, but as vanilla CSS, compiling that down so your compiled CSS still uses CSS variables, but then passing that CSS file through post CSS and then compiling that down to static CSS afterwards. So it means you can start using really new features, run it through SAS, then for old browsers, run it through post CSS. So a tool chain that involves both is quite nice. But yeah, I'm still for the most part using SAS because I work with companies who've got code that has only just started using SAS anyway, and they've got so much legacy that they can't switch technologies very quickly.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Just throwing it out there, like do most of the companies now have responsive websites now, or do you still already deal with companies that have fixed layouts still, or like, where is it?
Good question. I think nowadays, I think most companies I've worked with have, In fact, I would say nearly all companies I've worked with have a responsive site, or if it isn't responsive, they at least have a decent MDOT site instead.
Okay.
I haven't worked with a company for a long, long time who's got fully like fixed layout pages, which is good. I've never even thought about that. That actually is, that's quite good that I'm getting to work with companies who are adopting stuff, or it's good that companies are adopting things that quickly.
Right. And is it really good to say decent MDOT site? I don't think that's really... You know, I don't think you use the words decent and M site in the same.
Oh man, this is a big question. I actually think there's a time and place for both. So I don't.
A politician's answer. Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm not. I think responsive. If you can do a responsive site, do it. Absolutely. The business case alone of build once and supply everywhere is amazing. You know. It's a last resort to use an MDOT site, but certain websites just can't be made responsive. And I know everyone says that, well, you're not trying hard enough, but genuinely I've worked on projects where you cannot have a responsive, like betting applications. I used to work on for a gambling company. Making those kind of applications responsive is really difficult. They're more dashboardy. So completely different design paradigms are often a requirement. But ultimately, ideally, I would like to see responsive everywhere.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I just, yeah, you know, sometimes the M sites are just terrible. So that's why I can maybe.
Yeah. Well, on the flip side, though, even on desktop, I still go to Wikipedia's MDOT site. I think the m.wikipedia.org is so much nicer than their mobile, than their desktop site, that I actually use MDOT everywhere. Yeah.
You know, I think I'm trained as a Wikipedia user just to enjoy, I know how to get my way around Wikipedia's desktop site. I never really thought about their mobile version. Yeah. So yeah.
That's Stockholm syndrome right there.
Yeah, exactly. You show me the way out, man. I need to, you open the door. So you're not captured anymore. You take off. One thing I read an interview, you know, you're speaking at CSIS DevConf in October. And so, yeah, it's in New Orleans. It'd be awesome. I read some interviews about, marketing yourself and that, you know, you didn't go to college. So you actually, kind of like put your effort into your online, persona, I guess, you know, CSS Wizardry is your website. And so, which is, a great thing. So like one thing is, you know, I'm trying to point this into, you know, your thoughts on marketing yourself, you know, as and getting your name out there. Like, how do you feel, where you are now? Because I feel like, because in the past interview you said like you want to make sure you write quality posts over quantity, which is a great thing, but then also just want if there's any words of encouragement for other people who might be listening and you also want to be speakers or more known in the industry.
So. Yeah, well, I mean, I get asked this quite a lot because I think a lot of a common misconception is that I've always had kind of a name or always had a bit of a presence. But what I started blogging 10 years ago. It's taken a long time. Now there are shortcuts. There are definitely shortcuts. So you could register a domain name and just hammer out millions of articles, not of necessarily low quality, but of just kind of rapid fire stuff to quickly kind of scattergun and build up kind of, I guess that's kind of a strategy that a social media company might tell you to take, is just like have an updated Twitter profile, have the list. My advice is kind of quality over quantity, absolutely, slow and steady. But here's one thing that most people who ask me this question, I get it asked a lot at workshops and conferences when there are a lot of junior developers around. A lot of people ask me like, oh, how did you get where you got to? How did you get to become like a, you know, how did you get to where you got to? I almost singularly attribute it to having a blog. I think having a blog is the single most valuable thing I've ever done. And then the next thing I say to them is, do you have a blog? And everybody always says no. And I'm like, well, your homework this weekend is start a blog. And don't start on Medium. Don't go to Medium and set up a Medium blog. Go and build yourself a crude, nasty, just cheap and cheerful blog on your own domain and just write stuff down. And then they say things like, the conversation always goes the same way. It's like, well, people won't read it. It's like, well, if you don't have it, they literally can't read it. if you don't have a blog, it's impossible for them to read it. But just by having a blog, there are an infinite amount of times more likely that people are going to be reading your blog. So just having it. And then they say things like, oh, well, yeah, but I should have started 5 years ago. You know, like it's too late to kind of start now. And there's an old, this sounds really kind of tacky and really cheesy and very like twee, but there's an old proverb, which is the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. Second best time to plant a tree is right now. So a lot of people go into this kind of like this, not fallacy, but this kind of this thought process of, well, if I was going to do blogging, I should have started it 5 years ago. It's like, well, you should have done, but you didn't. So start it now. Don't start it in 5 years time. Start it now. Go home tonight. Just get a Jekyll blog, get a horrible cheap WordPress theme, just something. Cause you don't know what's going to happen. I think the way I got kind of more well known is I was just writing stuff kind of just to no one in particular. I didn't have a following. I was just writing things that as I was learning them, I was sharing them. Cause I was like, oh, this is really cool. This new CSS3 thing does this. And I would just blog about it just because that's how I learned. I learned from other people's generosity, right? So I was like, oh, just, that's what people do. We blog things and no one was reading it. And then one day, Smashing Magazine picked up on one of my articles and they tweeted it. And this was in 2009, I think. And all of a sudden, people were hitting my site and it had like more traffic than it ever had before. And because I was on Smashing Mag's radar, they would share more things, they would share other things. So yeah, I think the single biggest thing anyone could do is have a blog. And then after that, it's things like go and speak at meetups. Yeah, start with a blog. It's been the, I'd say it's the most useful thing I've had in my career.
Right. And I totally support that because as a conference organizer and someone who loves the web and everything like that, it's like I tweet resources all the time and usually they are people's blogs and I don't tweet or promote, and I also have a newsletter. I really don't tweet and put links to other people's tweets. You know, or what? You know, I put the links to Medium articles, of course, but I would rather link to your blog. And also, you know, that's someone who's researching the web, but also as a conference organizer, you know, and also who works on the web, you know, this Leo Veru story is one that I do because, like, I kept on going back to this web page. It was kind of this orange pinkish theme. And it finally dawned on me after the third time reading the third article about CSS. You know, 3 or something like that, or whatever. It's like, I should probably check out who this person is. And I was like, oh, it's, you know, it's someone named Leah Rue. And I should probably, like, I wonder if she wants to speak at my conference because she obviously knows what she's talking about. Right. And so that's, you know, that's this.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You've got no idea who's reading, right? So right. I got a friend who, he's actually become quite well known and you actually know him. I'm not going to name him, but you know him. And he wrote a blog. He didn't really think many people were reading it. It turns out one day a guy who was a hiring manager at Facebook ended up on my friend's blog. And he was reading this article, this kind of inconsequential article, but the guy reading it thought, you know, this is actually really good. We could use someone like this on our team. And he reached out to my friend and said, hey, I just found your article by accident, but I'm a hiring manager at Facebook. Do you want to interview for Facebook? Now, that was just because, like you say, you just happen to be on someone's site and you could offer that person something. It's a speaking opportunity. It's a job. That's amazing. Like, we'll just go into them. So, you're completely right.
Right. Yeah, and you don't have to be on the web to do it. I mean, I feel like if it's any industry would benefit from it. So, if you're, like, not on the web or if you're just listening or you're marketing in web or if you're, you know, hiring in web, like, no, just... You know, it doesn't have to be web, but it could be any other industry. But just saying, like, even if you're on periphery, I think just having it out there. And so and with GitHub Pages and Jekyll, I think it's a no-brainer for people to get started right away. So
yeah.
But yeah.
Definitely, man. Definitely.
Yeah, because I feel like people also ask me, like, how can I speak? And I just, like, just blog and meetups. And then the new book from Laura Hogan, I think that's how it's pronounced, from Event Apart, from Book Apart. About public speaking, I think that's pretty much is like just an awesome book on how to get started, getting in the industry too. So, but but we'll wrap it up. How can people find you on the internet and learn more about you and workshops?
If anyone wants to find me on the internet, first bit of advice: don't Google my name because I share my name with a British serial killer. So if you Google me, you'll get the wrong result. CSS Wizardry is where I blog, so cssWizardry.com. if people are interested in performance, large-scale CSS, architectural concerns. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's about it.
Okay, awesome. Well, I appreciate you taking the time today and being here and sharing your advice and expertise.
Absolutely, my pleasure. And I'll be seeing you. When will I be seeing you?
October 9th and 10th at New Orleans for CSS DevConf.
Absolutely. I can't wait. It's going to be so good.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. Cool. Awesome. Well, see you then.